Our third case for this morning is United States against Marcus Hayden. Okay, Mr. Jeevers, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Robert Giebers on behalf of the appellant, Marcus Hayden. We're here this morning as a result of the District Court's denial of the motion to suppress filed. That denial of the motion to suppress was preserved by Mr. Hayden through a plea agreement so that he could appeal it to this Court.
I have a practical question to ask you.
Yes, ma'am.
Could the gun have fit in the pocket that Hayden was reaching for?
Your Honor, good question. I do not know the answer to that. There was no evidence within the testimony at the suppression hearing as to the actual size of the pocket that he was reaching for.
Because I understand at least his version of this is that he was trying to pull out an ID to show that nobody could, quote unquote, you can't talk to me or something. But was the pocket in these baggy pants, or was it a shirt pocket?
It was in the left rear of the pants pocket.
Okay. That probably could fit.
The Court is correct. He was just simply walking down the street that evening. It was light out. He was minding his own business. It was a couple of days after this alleged robbery that he was a suspect in that they wanted simply to question him for. When the squad car, though not fully marked, I believe the testimony was that it was quite obviously a squad car. Everyone knew that. With a uniform officer who immediately gets out and walks up to Mr. Hayden. There, in those officers' mind, officers Hensler and Smith, they were simply alerted that detectives wanted to question him. There's the whole issue of whether or not we can impute the probable cause that the detectives may have had to Officers Hensler and Smith. But they were simply asked, and it was clear that they had heard radio traffic immediately before finding the defendant, that it was simply an attempt to locate and question.
But I guess one thing that comes out in the suppression hearing, and I was very interested about this, was whether there was evidence before the district court that that he was going to be questioned as a suspect or whether he was going to be questioned as a witness or in some other capacity. And they testify they're going to question him as a suspect. And so I guess to cut to the chase, I have a lot of trouble seeing why this isn't at a minimum a Terry stop. I mean, we have plenty of law that says the police can just walk up to somebody in the street and say, hey, we'd like to talk to you. Please do that. And there's no, you don't need anything for that. And they've got, collectively, a certain amount of information about Mr. Hayden and this robbery. So why, and by the time it's Terry stop, everything else flows from it.
Your Honor, I believe that at the time it was a Terry stop, under Michigan versus Chestnut, a pedestrian doesn't have to stop and answer the questions that are put to him by the police.
True, he doesn't, but when he reacts the way Mr. Hayden did, doesn't that give the police a little more suspicion where he starts to elude them and makes a motion toward a pocket?
And particularly with their background information, where they've been told, you know, this guy is, you know, dangerous, et cetera.
They know Mr. Hayden. There's no doubt about that. They've had prior dealings with him. They say in their testimony that he was anxious at first when they pull up. I submit I'd be anxious when the black squad car pulled up behind me and I'm walking down the street and one jumps out and says, hey, Bob, we want to talk to you. Then he simply makes a movement. They're not saying that it was a furtive movement. They're not saying that it was a movement. There was no testimony at that point other than that they had background information about prior involvements that he had that they were concerned for their safety.
But at the time he makes that movement, I thought they already knew that there were all these codes in the system about Mr. Hayden.
Yes, Your Honor, they did. And in fact, one of the officers, I have to agree, knew from within a week, had been sent to the scene of a prior complaint where Mr. Hayden supposedly had made threats to shoot another individual. All of that being said, there was nothing that evening as he was walking down the street in broad daylight.
But you don't treat a person with that background like you might Joe Citizen that you've never seen before, never heard of, and didn't have that kind of information. There is some justification, isn't there, for an officer to treat a person that they know these things about a little bit differently in making a Terry stop?
I think, sir, they can certainly take that into consideration and must be very careful. At this point, however, even Officer Smith testified that Officer Hensler was on Mr. Hayden immediately. They said, hey, we want to talk to you. He says, I don't have any warrants. If I got an ID card, and he's exercising his right to just keep walking. The fact that he simply reaches to get an ID card, well, certainly they can stop him and say, wait a minute, Marcus, don't do that.
Well, if they know it's an ID card, they've got some comfort, but they don't
yes,
know it.
They don't know that. That is correct. They do not know that. But I think at that point...
So why at that point can't they with, you know, maybe it is inevitable to get to this collective knowledge doctrine, but why at that point can't they do a frisk? You know, an officer safety, they've got articulable suspicions, they have the background information, they know that they've got these various codes on him, he's reaching for his pocket, as Judge Tinder says, they don't know what's in the pocket, a gun, an ID card, you know, a snack, whatever. You know, and they just do a frisk to make sure that he's not about to pull something out and hurt somebody.
When they're there that evening, obviously we have to rely on what they're seeing and doing. I understand that.
True. Yeah.
I'm concerned, however, that in every such instance when there's the code X or an individual is tagged as being a, quote, danger, that this provides somewhat of a carte blanche to the officers then to walk up to anybody who is code X and conduct a Terry frisk simply because the individual is wanted for questioning.
Does it matter to you if it's questioning as a suspect versus questioning as a witness?
No, Your Honor, it does not, because at this point they're simply asking that they wanted to have questions. He doesn't have to answer those questions. He doesn't have to submit to that police interrogation, if you will. These officers, the patrol officers themselves, weren't going to ask him questions. You know, he even says the detectives want to ask you some questions. So does that mean they're going to detain him and take him involuntarily to the station? Mr. Hayden is correct that he doesn't have to stop. He can simply keep walking. So I don't believe there is a distinction between whether he's a witness or a suspect. A witness can exercise that right as well and continue to walk down the street. Further, I don't believe that it matters whether or not there's actually probable cause at that time to arrest him for this alleged robbery. The officers on patrol simply hear the radio traffic that there is an attempt to locate, we found him, and the detectives want to talk with him. They don't know all the facts and circumstances surrounding the alleged robbery. That has not been supplied to them. They simply hear the radio traffic from Officer Hoffman.
But they don't need to know all those background facts. If they're told, bring in Mr. Hayden, I know it's not quite what was said, but hypothetically, if they're told, we need you to bring in Mr. Hayden because there's been a robbery, they don't need to know anything else but that, do they?
They don't need to know that, but at the same time, if there's not a warrant, can they simply pick Mr. Hayden up off the street and say, get in the back of the squad car, we're going?
If there's probable cause and they're told, you know, we're on the lookout for Mr. Hayden for the robbery, why can't they do that?
I think we distinguish some of the cases that have come down, Hensley out of the Supreme Court, Sawyer out of the Seventh Circuit, where the courts have talked about there is that collective knowledge of the probable cause the patrol officer doesn't need to. I think we distinguish those. Hensley talks about a bulletin that came from out of state. The detention there was simply to check whether or not an arrest warrant had been issued. That's all that. So they detained him because they wanted to check. When doing so, they uncover or see in plain view a gun, and it proceeds. In Sawyer, they actually see him, they want to talk with him, he drops something and runs, Mr. Sawyer does, and the chase is on. So I think there's a distinguishing factor here that collectively they may have had probable cause, But these officers were simply told, we want to ask him questions. He's a suspect. And they took it too far when he simply tries to exercise his right to walk on down the street.
If you want to save just a bit.
Thank you, yes.
Mr. Geller?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Anthony Geller for the United States. Pursuant to the collective knowledge doctrine and pursuant to the Hensley case that Mr. Gievers here referenced just a moment ago, it was appropriate for the officers to rely upon really what amounted to an attempt to locate Mr. Hayden. And one thing that you'll notice if you look at the facts of Hensley, the bulletin in that case was actually very similar. And in effect, it asked for other departments in that case to locate the individual and to essentially hold him for questioning by that other department. The only thing that's really different in our case is that it was a bulletin that was within the Fort Wayne Police Department. So the collective knowledge doctrine in Hensley essentially says that the key is communication. That if the originator of the bulletin, in this case it's the detective who investigated the armed robbery, if the originator had probable cause or reasonable suspicion to justify the actions that occur thereafter, then the stop or the arrest is constitutional.
But they just tell detective, they ask Officer Hoffman because they want to question him as a suspect. They don't actually say anything to Officer Hoffman like, we'd like to arrest him, you know. I'm wondering if the level of the information is really the same as it was in the Hensley case.
I would say it's very similar, Your Honor. The information was actually, we want to talk to him. Essentially, the information as the testimony came out was, we need you to look for Mr. Hayden, and we want you to bring him down to the police station for questioning. Now, we can argue about whether that's an arrest or not, simply bringing the fellow down to the police station for questioning. And you know, as you know, the Dunaway case essentially says that unless there are other things, like the officers tell the person they are not under arrest, or some other things that tend to make it more voluntary that the person comes to the station, what they're really doing is arresting the person. So in effect, what Detective Quaid informed the officers was, we need you to find this guy, we need you to bring him down to the station so we can talk to him.
Well, if that's the case, I mean, if we have to look at this realistically and assume that they said, go out and arrest Mr. Hayden and bring him in involuntarily, we don't care if he wants to come in or not, you need to bring him in, then we really need to go all the way up to the probable cause level, don't we? Terry would not be enough?
I disagree with that, Your Honor. The officers actually conducted this stop at first as a reasonable suspicion stop, as a Terry stop. And if you look at it, I guess it matters more what the officer actually does when they encounter Mr. Hayden. If they simply arrested him, then sure, we would have to assess it on a probable cause standard at the outset of it. However, these officers took a more measured approach, and perhaps it was because of the ambiguity in, well, go arrest Mr. Hayden, and they didn't say that. They said, go bring him in for questioning. Perhaps that was the reason why they decided to do it that way.
So suppose Mr. Hayden, when the officer was approaching him, instead of reaching for his back pocket ambiguously, had just kept walking. Any difference there?
No difference, Your Honor.
The officer just jogs along with Mr. Hayden and tries to talk to him, or can the officer actually physically stop him?
The officer can physically stop him in this instance, Judge. The reason why I say that is, getting back to the collective knowledge doctrine, we have to go back to the originator of the bulletin or of the attempt to locate. The detectives here had more than reasonable suspicion. They had probable cause to arrest Mr. Hayden for the armed robbery. They had a victim who had identified him in a photo array, had described him, had described his tattoos, described the robbery. It was clearly an armed robbery. And there was nothing, as the district court found, there was nothing factually that would cause the officers not to believe her. And she was even consistent in her account. So there's probable cause to arrest him at this point. They could have forcibly arrested him had he walked away, had he fled. Had he been more cooperative and simply walked away, perhaps they could have insisted he stop, you know, those sorts of things, and then proceeded, you know, in a more measured way as opposed to simply, you know, grabbing him and then frisking him. But no, Your Honor, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever, because the fact, whatever he does, doesn't change the fact that the officers, the detectives, imputed to the officers, have probable cause to arrest Mr. Hayden, and at the very least, at a bare minimum, they have reasonable suspicion to stop him and find out perhaps, and this is exactly what they did. Once they got him stopped, once they got him under control, they actually called the detective on call, Detective Roddy, who actually made the scene. Detective Roddy even went so far as to talk to the victim again and confirm her account of the armed robbery. And Detective Roddy is really the one that makes the decision ultimately to arrest Mr. Hayden, bring him to the police station. Now, I understand that occurs after the marijuana and the handgun are found, and after it's found that he doesn't have a license and those sorts of things. So he's arrested. He's going to be arrested anyway on the handgun and marijuana at that point. But, I mean, Detective Roddy comes out to the scene in this case. So we have clear communication among those that receive the bulletin report and those that have the underlying factual knowledge. So I think it's quite clear. I mean, the collective knowledge doctrine applies in this case. Hensley applies in this case. The knowledge of not only Detective Quate, but of Detective Roddy is imputed to the officers. There's probable cause to arrest Mr. Hayden. At the very least, there's reasonable suspicion. There's quite clearly a fear for officer safety. I don't want to necessarily belabor the point, but Mr. Hayden was someone who was suspected in committing multiple homicides by shooting. He had just committed, they had probable cause to believe, he had just committed an armed robbery with a handgun not 2 days before. And as Mr. Gevers mentioned, not even a week before, the officer that actually personally stopped him was involved in investigating a threat that Mr. Hayden had with actually shooting up the house of a civilian witness. And this is in addition to all these codes and alerts and so forth that are in the police database. So quite clearly there's reasonable suspicion to stop. There's probable cause to arrest. The frisk is proper, and the collective knowledge doctrine applies. So the government would request that you affirm the conviction and affirm the denial of the motion to suppress. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Gevers?
Thank you, yes. I'd just like to briefly touch on this. If he had continued to walk down the street, would they have arrested? They had no reason to. The information they had was an attempt to locate for questioning. That's not what happened in Hensley. In Hensley, they stopped to see if there were a warrant. The patrol officers in this instance were not told there was a warrant, had no reason to believe it. So they kept, if he had kept walking, they would have. It's interesting to note that even Detective Roddy testified that the arrest for the alleged robbery did not occur until after Mr. Hayden was brought down to the scene, after he had reviewed Detective Quate's report, after he had called the victim one more time and had a brief conversation with her, and then he arrested based on probable cause. So I think it's distinguishing here. I understand the collective knowledge, but these officers were only told, we want to question him, and that's where it should have stopped. If he's going to exercise his right to keep walking, they have no reason to keep pursuing him. We would ask the court to overturn or reverse the suppression denial and remand this to the district court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And, Mr. Gevers, you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, thank you.
We appreciate very much your assistance to the court and to your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you as well.